an evening with friends, and great stories. My name is Kai West, and I would like to thank Betty Pierce, Pat Chesbro, and Emily Forstner for inviting me again to once again MC for the evening. They're not sick of me yet, so I'm going to punish them. I'm going to sing. There's a story I must tell. Friends and family know it well. So I'm sharing. Thanks for caring. Here's a story I will tell. One of the most precious commodities we have is our time, and we don't seem to have enough of it, except when there comes time to listen to a story or even tell it. I was recently asked by a friend of mine, as we were sitting across from lunch, to tell my own story, and the first two things I felt were I was honored and excited. Honored because he wanted to actually spend some time and listen to my story, and excited because I got to tell it again. So we've all been there. We've all had someone we walk up to and, oh, how you doing? Oh, good, fine, as you walk away. But if they stop and they look at you, you feel honored. They're giving some of their time to listen to your story. And that's what you're doing tonight, and we are honored. And we're excited because you not only stopped, you gave us a little bit of money, and you sat down. So we are honored and excited to share our untold stories with you. I'm going to get right to it because we have seven fantastic stories. Our first, gotta look at my program. Kathy Ashmore Roberts is going to come up. Kathy is a wife and mother of three wonderful sons. She's retired, and she worked for many years as a nurse and a care coordinator. And so while Kathy's coming up, we're going to sing to you, Kathy. Here's a story I must tell. Friends and family know it well. So I'm sharing. Thanks for caring. Here's my story I will tell.
Well, my story is about coming back to Alaska. Originally, I moved to Alaska in 1983 and settled in Palmer, intending to stay for a year, and then I was going back to the Northeast. Well, 10 years later, I decided to move my three sons and I back to the Northeast, to Maine, where my family of origin lives. I really missed them and thought I wanted to be there. As soon as I got there, I realized I had made a mistake. As much as I love my family, I knew that for the boys and for me, Palmer, Alaska was home. So I saved my money for 5 years, and the boys and I planned our trip back to Alaska. We rented a U-Haul trailer and hitched it to our 1974 Chevy van. And on a hot July day, myself as the only driver, and my three sons, Jesse, 13, Scott, 12, and Sean, 9, our three dogs, Sonny, Old Dan, and Little Ann, and our hamster named Mr. Gerb, started out down the driveway. We had Mr. Gerb settled down in a nice bed of cedar shavings, and the windows were open because it was really hot, and the van filled up with cedar shavings. So we had to stop and rethink that plan. Our first stop was in New Hampshire at a friend's house, where Old Dan promptly jumped out of the van and killed their rooster. So my friends gave us some doggy downers for Dan and wished us luck. I knew we were going to need a lot more than luck, and really was seriously questioning my judgment about thinking I could drive us all 5,000 miles to Alaska. But adventure lay ahead of us, and so we proceeded on our way. we decided to cross into Canada near Niagara Falls, and when we got to customs, the customs officer who checked us through asked me if I had any weapons, and I said no. And she said, "You don't even have a can of mace?" And I said, "No, I have three boys and three dogs. Who's going to mess with me?" She sort of laughed and waved us on our way. When driving around, the Great Lakes was really beautiful, and we got to stop several times at Lake Superior, and the boys and the dogs took a dip. We weren't in any hurry. We had planned to take about 16 days on our trip because we were camping. We were also cooking on a little propane stove, and we knew we wouldn't make a great deal of progress in any given day. When we got to Manitoba, I started having some trouble with one of the tires on the U-Haul. I had to put air in it every day. So I stopped at a U-Haul place, and they gave me a new tire. I begged them to give me a spare, telling them I was driving all across Canada, and there were many miles between service stations in a lot of places, but they said it's against our policy and they wouldn't give it to me. I had asked them the same thing in Maine, and they wouldn't give me one there either. So we went on our way. When we got to Saskatchewan, we stopped at a little general store one day, and old Dan jumped out the window of the van and into a sheep pen and started to chase the sheep around. It took all of us to corral him and get him back in the van, but fortunately no sheep were harmed. By the time we got to Saskatchewan, I was beginning to feel a little bit more confident. I felt like we had made it this far and we might actually be able to pull this off. When we got to Alberta, I decided to have my transmission fluid changed. My mechanic had advised me to do that about halfway. So we stopped in Grand Prairie, and I got directions to the lube center. And as I was heading in that direction, I could see the building. So I took a right turn, only to realize I had turned onto a one-way street going the wrong way. Well, I hadn't really practiced backing up the trailer, so it took us quite a long time to back into the road that we had turned off of. I was laughing hysterically because I was embarrassed, and the boys were horrified that I was laughing. But the drivers in Grand Prairie, much to their credit, were very patient, and no one even honked a horn at me. When we got backed around into the street we had turned off of, a clown standing on the corner came up to the window and handed my youngest son, Sean, a balloon and said, "Welcome to Grand Prairie, the city of one-way streets." We got into British Columbia and stopped one evening at a campground, and my middle son, Scott, decided that he was going to take the one bike we had for a little spin around the campground. Well, soon he was back with a scared look on his face, and he said, "I'm really sorry, Mom, I wiped out on my bike." Well, his knee was just embedded with gravel. It was much worse than anything I could deal with my first aid kit. So we went and talked to the campground hosts, and there was a little hospital named Valley Hospital about 10 miles east of where we were. So we took a ride over to the ER, and they scrubbed the gravel out of Scott's knee and patched him up. And dinner was a little bit late that night. We camped in beautiful Muncho Lake and had a very nice overnight there. In the morning, we had a flat tire on the van, so I sent my oldest son over to see if the campground host was there. I was really reluctant to unhook the trailer from the van, because I was afraid I wouldn't get it hooked back up properly. But we couldn't find the campground host, so I sent the boys and the dogs away from the van and jacked it up and put the spare on. Well, pretty soon we were on our way, and we got to a service station of sorts. There was one guy there, And he said he couldn't fix the tire and he didn't have any tires to sell me. But he directed me up the road to a service station that was about 200 miles away. But we made it on the spare and were able to get the tire fixed. I was really thankful that we actually made it on that spare tire. We really wanted to get to Alaska by Jesse's birthday, which was the 30th of July. And on the 29th of July, we pulled into Beaver Creek, which is not that far from the border. It was about 7 in the evening, and we were going to continue on our way, but we had a flat on the U-Haul, and it was raining. I had passed a tire store on the way into town, but it was closed. And so I decided to get us a motel room, and we snuck the dogs and Mr. Gerb into the hotel room. And in the morning, I made the boys swear they would be quiet and keep the dogs quiet. And I went down and jacked up the trailer and took the tire off and started walking down the road toward the tire store. Well, a pickup pulled up, and the driver said to me, "What are you doing walking that tire down the road? Throw it in the back." And so I tossed it in the back of the pickup, and he took off. So I hoped he was going to the tire store with my tire. And I walked to the tire store, and when I got there, the owner was fixing my tire, and I complained to him that I had begged them in Winnipeg and in Maine to give me a tire, and he said, "Well, I'm a U-Haul contractor, and it's an insurance thing. They don't want anybody changing tires on their rigs on the side of the road." But when he was done, he had someone give me a ride back to the trailer, and they dropped me off, and I put the tire back on the trailer. And so on the morning of July 30th, on Jesse's 14th birthday, we left Beaver Creek and drove to the border of Alaska and crossed into Alaska, and we were home.
Oh, excellent. I had the privilege of actually listening to these stories last week, and these ladies and this gentleman are a little bit nervous, so you did a fantastic job, and so now I'm going to punish you and sing. We love the story that you told. You were brave and you were bold. It's exciting to think of writing my own story that's untold. This next wonderful story is by Mary Maxwell. Mary has lived and worked in Fairbanks and Homer, but now she works in Anchorage, and she lives in Palmer because she loves the small, close community. For fun, she takes art classes at Matsu Community College, where she can make use of the views available in this beautiful Matsu Valley. Let's welcome Mary Maxwell.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. Isn't it great to come out to Palmer and listen to stories? I love this community. My story begins in 1956 on Thanksgiving Day. We lived at a ranger station in Dunsmuir, California, where my dad worked for the Forest Service. He spent about a year working small fires, working at lookouts, and doing firefighter jobs. But he was tired of working for the Forest Service and tired of living in California. And he decided to quit his job and move back to the state of Washington, where I was born, where he lived to fly fish in the Cascade Mountains of Washington. He had one regret. That regret was that he'd never had the chance to work just one great big fire. On the night of Thanksgiving, when we sat down to have dinner, a young boy, 16 years old, in Southern California, struck a match and threw it into the grass to see if it would burn. The firefighters, including my dad, traveled to Southern California to fight the fire. They crawled down into the steep canyon in the dark. The canyon was full of boulders, chaparral, snakes, and they began to cut a line. Later, when buttonholes of fire popped up all around them, the fire boss told them to start working their way toward the safe zone and the crest of the hill or the canyon rim. What he should have said to them was, throw down your tools and run for your life. He didn't. They fell just 200 feet from the rim of the canyon, overcome by smoke and explosive fire. Everyone grieves in their own way. My mom had it really hard. She had three little kids to raise. She had to figure out how to make a living, how to go on. We all have to go on, right? I was particularly difficult. I was a daddy's girl. I ate the gizzard of the chicken because he ate it. I ate the heel of the bread because he ate it. I don't even like these things. And when he'd come home from the Cascades with a batch of fish, I'd sit in the dark and clean the fish with the hose outside. I was angry when my dad died, and that anger continued. When I was about 17, I dropped out of high school, caused my mother all kinds of grief, ran away from home, got my GED, never expecting to go to college, and within a couple years, I was married and had a child. Later, when I was about 40, I faced grief again. This time, I knew I had to deal with it, but I wasn't sure how. I wasn't sure how to go forward. I thought, my mother had remarried, she and her husband had moved to Alaska, my brother came home from the Vietnam War, joined the police department in Anchorage, so I had plenty of family in Anchorage, and I could easily have moved to Alaska. But something in the back of my brain just kept saying, Mary, you have to deal with this grief. You have to, or you can't go on. So on a lark, I called a friend of mine who worked in the downtown federal building of San Diego, home to the headquarters of the Cleveland National Forest. And I said, would you go upstairs and just poke your head in the door and ask if anyone remembers or knows anything about the Inaha fire of 1956? Well, my friend did this, and a man stuck his head out from behind a cubicle like this and said, who wants to know about that fire? And my friend explained that it was Mary Maxwell and that her father had been killed in that fire. The man stood up and walked out from behind the cubicle this time, and he said, tell Mary I was with her father the night he died. Well, you know what I did, right? I sold everything I owned. I quit my job, to my mother's horror, and reduced my belongings into what would fit into the back of my pickup truck, and I drove south to meet Dick Marlowe. I listened as he told the stories of standing in a snowstorm-like atmosphere of ashes falling after the fire and thinking that the ashes were part of the men that had died. I met another man who took me to the place where my father had fallen and showed me the simple stone erected by the firefighters who survived the fire, the stone marking the place where the men fell. And later, on an unremarkable day, the most remarkable thing happened to me. I was talking to a woman from the Cleveland. I was probably asking about a fire report or something. I can't remember. And she said to me, Mary, you know about the scholarship, right, for children of firefighters and police officers killed by violence? The scholarship that allows you to go to the California State University system tuition-free for the rest of your life? Of course, I had no idea. Neither my brother, sister, or I had taken advantage of this, and I had no hope of ever going to college as far as I knew. Well, once more, you know what I did, right? In 1997, I graduated from Humboldt State University with a degree in biology and a minor degree in ornithology. I had discovered birds. This great gift came to me. Later, my Uncle Cal, my dad's younger brother, would tell me how my dad had always wanted to go to Alaska. and how when he was young, he had flashcards of birds he kept in his back pocket wherever he went so that he could identify birds. In the end, I dealt with my grief, and I got the greatest gift, the gift of Alaska.
Thank you for sharing that wonderful story with us. On your program, the front, there's an amazing picture. I didn't do the programs, by the way, but I came in and I saw this picture, and I thought, how cool is that? And then someone said, I think that's a picture of Betty Pierce and her family driving up the Elkan, right?
I wasn't born yet, but
so enjoy that picture. I'm loving it. 1958. Well, this next story might have something to do with that, I think. We have Becky Oviatt, right? Becky has been an Alaska resident for 23 years, the last 13 years in Palmer. She raises goats, sheep, and chickens, and she runs a yarn fiber business online, and her story is Truckin' the Inside Passage. Sorry, let's welcome her.
Hi, it's wonderful to see a bunch of friendly faces out in the audience, people that I've gotten to know since I've moved here. I was a traveling nurse, and I was working in Elko, Nevada, and had talked to another nurse who said that she had been to Alaska, and I thought, well, that's something I'm never going to do. Well, I had contracted for another... My train just derailed. I had contracted for another job in Mississippi, and I thought, just something really, really felt wrong. So I contacted another agency and said, okay, what do you got? And they said, well, we happen to have this job up in Alaska. I'm like, I'm there. Okay. So they paid for the travel, paid for everything for us to get up here, and booked us on the ferry. And I said, wow, okay, ferry. First they told me the Alaska Marine Highway, and I went, what? So we packed up our belongings into my truck, which was a green Ford, and we covered it with a tarp, a blue one, of course. We're going to Alaska, after all. And then covered it with a green tarp and one of those spider web things that we attached to a broom and a mop, all of the clampets, and off we went. Well, we hit somewhere in Idaho and hit an ice fog storm, and I'm going, this is really scary. We were going through the mountain passes, and I was really just, I thought I was going to die, and I kept telling my husband, please turn around, I don't want to do this. And he said, no, we'll make it. Well, about an hour later, we got out of the ice fog, and ended up in Bellingham, where we boarded the ferry. Well, so here we are. It's December 31st. We're going to spend New Year's Eve on the ferry. And not only that, I wasn't on a cruise ship, but by golly, I was going to cruise the Inside Passage. So I did. It was a beautiful, beautiful December, and we ran around on the deck of the ferry taking pictures of all the animals and all the scenery and everything, and I wish I had my digital camera because that would have made a lot better pictures. So the other thing we did, because after all, when you spend a week on a ferry with a bunch of people, you kind of get to know them. So we made friends, and we played cribbage. Oh, did we play cribbage. So when we were not running around on the deck, we were playing cribbage. I don't think I've played cribbage since. So I had, we had New Year's Eve dinner on the ferry. The ferry put on a beautiful, beautiful spread, at least for ferry food. And then we went into the dining room and sat, and guess what we did? We played cribbage. There were no fireworks. There were no, buzzers or anything, but it was the best New Year's Eve I've ever had. We landed in Haines, and I said, I got off the ferry, and I'm just like, oh, my God, I'm home. I didn't know if, on the back of my T-shirt, it says, I'm from Wisconsin. It says, Alaska is Wisconsin on crack. I just looked around, and I just went, oh, my gosh, all this snow. I thought I was getting away from snow when I started traveling nursing, because I was going to Mississippi. But no, I came up to Alaska. So we stayed the night in Haines, got together with a couple other travelers that were coming up this way, and decided to caravan up. We went to up the highway, and we saw the eagles, of course, in Haines, which was amazing because I had never seen more than one eagle in my life, ever. And then we kept on driving, and all of a sudden we go around this corner, and there's just white, just solid white. I said, how are we going to get through that? My husband says, just don't worry about it. Okay, fine. So we kept on going. Well, it turned out it was a mountain, which just looked like it was blocking the road. So there's a good train of thought again. So we finally got up to Beaver Creek. And, of course, as you know, that's just before the border. And we said to this guy at the front desk, okay, we want a room. Okay, yeah, I'll save the room for you, save the room, no problem. I said, well, we're going to go have dinner. So we went and had dinner, and thank God for the Canadians, I learned about pudding and hard cider, two things I still love. And we got back to him, and he said, oh, well, we don't have any more rooms. I said, what? I reserved a room. Yeah, but you went and had dinner, so I gave the room away. It was 50 below. We had no gas. And it was like, what, 10 o'clock at night? What are you going to do? I finally convinced him to let us, all of us, stay in one of the smaller rooms, which he really, really didn't like, but oh well. So anyway, after going out every 2 hours and starting the truck so that we would be able to get going in the morning, we continued on. The rest of the trip was rather uneventful, just scenery and all kinds of neat stuff like that. But when we got to Slana, we got out, and I'm looking at this incredible vista. And I saw the sun rising in the east and the moon setting in the west. And I went, oh, I know I'm home. So then we got to Anchorage, and I looked around and went, am I in Minneapolis? And where am I? I'm just in some big city here. But that's where I was scheduled to work, so we moved into a little daylight apartment, and were promptly greeted with a 5.0 earthquake. I watched the wall go up and down, and I went, oh boy. And about now, a year and a half later, my boss said to me, look, you've been here enough. Either sign on or get out of here. And I said, okay. I said, well, I'm not sure I'm done traveling, so I left. We went to Boston, wonderful trip, went back to Nashville, and then went home back home to Wisconsin. And the whole time, I'm going, no, this isn't home. This isn't nice. I don't like this. Hated Boston, hated Nashville. Hated going back home. There was this pull. The pull was Alaska. So I said to my husband, honey, I'm going back. He says, I don't want to go back to Alaska. I said, I'm going back to Alaska. You can come or not, but I'm going back. He came with me. We divorced. Little did I know that the pull bringing me back to Alaska was a man that I had met at a bar, typical, Typical story, right? We had just talked for a few minutes, but somehow we must have connected because, and we didn't even meet for, talk again or meet for years, years later, but we did. And when we did, we discovered that we had met before. Well, I got married, moved to Palmer, and this is where I've decided to transplant and grow.
Okay, I didn't read my program, obviously. That was not the Alcan. That was the Inside Passage.
I'm kind of jealous. I haven't done that. I really want to do that. This next guest is a wonderful treat. Her name is Pat Lawton. She was born and raised in Oklahoma. After high school, she went to Michigan for further education, and there she met and she married Lloyd. During the war, he worked in a defense plant, and it was at this time they had two children, Joe and Ginger. Soon after the armistice, he and a friend went north over the Alaska Highway in a surplus Jeep. And while he returned to Michigan not long after, the lure of Alaska was in him, and he returned for good in 1947. Once he found work in Palmer, he sent for Pat and the kids. Pat was active in her church, her PTA, homemakers, Little League, scouts. Parenting duties in the late 20th century. Typical parenting duties in the late 20th century. At the same time, she held secretarial positions at early versions of MTA, and the Bureau of Reclamation, which oversaw the Aklutna Power Project. Pat is the last, still alive, of eight siblings. Many of her descendants remain in the Matanuska Valley, and we are honored to have her come and tell her story. Let's give her a big round of applause.
She's going to hold it for me?
Yeah.
In 1938, I went to Mount Pleasant, Michigan, and then a short time later, I got a job with the 3A. It was Agricultural Administration Association. I had a coworker that lived on a farm near there, and she often talked about pheasant hunting because her boyfriend liked to hunt. Well, she had a friend in Saginaw, Michigan. That's where her boyfriend was from. And Lloyd Lawton, I met, who later became my husband in 1940. So we all went pheasant hunting. And Lloyd and his friend were going around the fields to flush the pheasants out so we could shoot them. And we didn't see any pheasants. But when they came, they were very alarmed because they said we were standing with our shotguns pointed at each other's feet. Well, I learned a lesson then that you never point a gun at something that you don't want to shoot. So anyway, my husband loved to hunt and fish. So this was on Saturday we got to do our hunting. But I did learn a valuable lesson that day. And in 1940, we got married, and I moved to Saginaw. He had worked for General Motors for 7 or 8 years, and they were building transmissions for cars. And so he liked his job real well, but he was a avid hunter and fisherman, and he always liked to go hunting, but there it was pheasant and deer. Well, he read the Alaska Sportsman where it had pictures of the bear and the moose, and he wanted to hunt big game. And he looked forward to the time that he could do that. And after we were married, he bought me a 20-gauge Remington double-barrel shotgun so because he thought the 16-gauge was too heavy for me. So I bought me a waterproof outfit so I'd really be all set for hunting. He never let me go deer hunting because he said there were too many trigger-happy people. Always there were a few people got shot during deer season, but they never seemed to get shot during pheasant season. some friends of ours came to Saginaw, where I lived with my husband, and they were from came from Palmer, Alaska. And they were, my husband got very excited. He, I want to go to Alaska, I want to go to Alaska. He'd always been so generous with letting me go to visit my family or on trips. I thought I should do something specially nice for him. So I made arrangements for this fellow that was driving back a new Jeep and leaving his wife in Saginaw for a while. I made arrangements for him to come back. And to help him drive. He was real delighted, the man was, that he was helping. But then someone else wanted to come, and this Ron that my husband drove up with wasn't excited about bringing him. So he encouraged this man to go to Fairbanks. Well, my husband hated to see this fellow go by himself because he was an older man, about 55, and I'm going to be 99 in 2 weeks. So my husband decided to go with this man to Fairbanks because he thought maybe he shouldn't go himself. Lloyd, my husband, could get a job with gold mining, but it paid the same as General Motors. He stayed for about 2 weeks, and then he flew back home. And his boss and everyone say, well, you got that out of your system. He says, I want to go back. I want to go back. And all he had seen was Fairbanks. So when this our friend's wife came later with their two little children, in the meantime, her husband had written and said there would probably he could get a job in Palmer. So he came up with my friend and their two little children. And I was going to come in May with my son, 5, Joe, and Ginger, who was 3. I was going to come in May because Joe was in kindergarten, and I was taking care of two little preschool children that also went to kindergarten. So anyway, he started, got a job with Al King's service station on Main Street in Palmer. And he started writing me and calling me and wanting me to come right away. Said our friends would have a little house for rent, and it's next door to where I live now. So I made arrangements to come to Alaska. And I had a lot to do with a little 3 and a 5-year-old. I had to rent the house, sell the car, get rid of 9 years of belongings, but we did pack a little steamer trunk and a little suitcase. Needless to say, there's many things I needed after I got here. I was able to sell the car for $1,600, which was exactly what we had paid for it in 1941, and we had had it, we sold it in 1947 because cars were at a premium. General Motors had changed over from to airplanes and shipbuilding during the war. We left Detroit on the 7th day of December, which was the anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and we were 23 hours getting to Alaska. on the way, on the trip, when we left Detroit, there was about a foot of snow. And I thought, oh dear, I'll probably live in a, who knows where I'll live in a tent and how much the snow. And but anyway, the mountains had beautiful snow, but we landed at Elmendorf Air Force, no snow, Palmer, no snow. We had no snow for Christmas. And I'd left a foot of snow at home. That was a real, real surprise. But I loved it. I loved it so much. We didn't have a car for a year and a half, which was kind of difficult for my husband because he had had a car since he was 15. But we did a lot of walking and walked to town, and I live a mile north of here, over by Sheridan Swanson School. Of course, there were no, those weren't schools. Everybody went to Central, went to the Borough Building. Everybody in the kindergarten to the seniors went to the Borough Building. And now I got to check my notes. Okay. After, while on the plane, the co-pilot came back and took Joe and Ginger up in the cabin to see all the workings of the plane. Well, Joe was real excited, but the little girl, she didn't care. And the navigator came back and brought a deck of cards, and we played pinochle. Played pinochle with him. There was one other woman on the plane with a little baby who was going back home, to, which was at Ladd Airfield in Fairbanks. So besides me and this other lady and my three-year-old girl was the only women on the plane. It was, as I said, it was Pacific Northern Airlines and real expensive. After a couple of years or three, you could fly to Detroit and back for $400 to $500 round trip. And we'd paid $1,600. But it was worth it. We loved it. There was a little building over by the co-op where the tower is, and it had been a post office. But the post office moved, and the electric company was in Kozlowski's building, and they moved into the little white building. I went in one day, which I walked to town every day to get my mail. You had to walk to town and to get the mail, and they had repainted the inside of what was the post office. I said, oh, it looks nice. How about a job? And the general manager says, when can you start? And I said, Monday? I was just making conversation, so I went to work. I went to work at the electric company. There were two women. The one woman was the general manager, and then the other woman, and then I went to work there, and five men when I worked at the electric company. Later on, I worked at the Bureau of Reclamation when they built the tunnel, and my boss called me the walking chamber of commerce. He said, Pat, you try to sell everybody on Alaska that comes to Alaska. You try to sell. Well, I loved it, and I loved the people, and I had so many friends. People were awfully friendly because they all had to leave their families when they came to Alaska, missed all of them except if there were colonists. And I didn't have that problem because I had lost my mother at 12 years old, and I had lived in Michigan for 9 years. I did have a father and some siblings back in the West, and I was able to visit them, but I loved Alaska. And as my boss said, I tried to sell it to everybody. But people were so friendly and so nice. It was no time at all. It seemed like you'd just been here forever. One friend that I walked to the post office with said, Pat, you speak to everybody. And I said, no, I don't think I do. She said, yes, you do. I'm not going to speak to the next person. And we parked by Bruce's gas station. Somebody is out there working. I said, oh, hi. She said, you weren't going to speak to everybody. But I guess I did. But Palmer has been a wonderful wonderful place. 69 years, I love it. And I love the people. And you couldn't find a better place. Thank you.
What an absolute blessing to have you come talk to us, Pep. Wow. I think I'm crying a little bit. That's amazing. We really should sing to her. We love your story that you told. You were brave and you were bold. It's exciting to think of writing my own story. That's untold. One more round of applause. We have to take a break so we can collect ourselves. So, take a break. Have some food from the Palmer Downtown Deli. They've got some good cannolis and other yummy things. Go ahead and stand up, take a break, take a bathroom break, and we will come back in. And Russ is going to play some fabulous music for us. Give Russ a big round of applause on his guitar. Ah, that's beautiful music. Thank you. As we're sitting down. We have our president of the board of directors for the Palmer Museum, Pat Chesbro. Give a round of applause.
I am not going to tell any stories tonight, but I am going to say thank you for coming. Thank you for supporting the museum. We really appreciate this, and I think, you know, it's the Palmer Museum of History and Art, and this certainly is history, is it not? So just I wanted to mention a couple of things that are coming up. One is our next, if you want to get your stories ready for the next episode of Untold Stories, it will be, and it's on your program, April 23rd, right here, same place, same time, and it's spring breakup, and so you can interpret that any way you want. But the stories are due on the 6th of April, and I know sometimes people wait till the last minute, but please think about submitting a story. All we ask of you is that you have an expanded outline. You don't have to write the whole thing out unless you want to, but an expanded outline so that our readers get a chance to really get a sense of what you're going to tell us. And then we have Kai and Emily Forstner do a coaching session with the folks to help them just kind of get comfortable with it, and we really, they've done a wonderful job, and so have our storytellers so far done a wonderful job, so we really appreciate everything that everybody does. A couple of things to think about is we have the other thing we have in February is If These Aprons Could Talk, and you might think that's kind of a strange title, but if you go to the museum right now, you will see a traveling exhibit of sort of the history of aprons. And it's really kind of an interesting thing to look at. You know, the full ones and the fancy ones that people used to wear, you know, when they were, you know, having a party. I never did, but, you know, so I don't even wear one when I'm cooking, so that's really unfortunate. But anyways, it's a great exhibit, and so we're good. Going to be If These Aprons Could Talk, and we're going to ask people who wear aprons at work to tell a little bit about the kinds of stories that their aprons would tell. And, you know, if you're a if you're a farrier or if you're a dentist, or and what are the aprons tell. And so that will be a little bit different. It's going to be at Vagabond Blues. It will be on the 19th of February. And if you want to wear an old apron you've got, that's great. And it's going to be just a donation kind of thing, because we really are trying to promote the exhibit that we have. So the other exciting thing that's coming up, and this will be July 7th, is our second annual wine walk. So we're doing things a little bit differently this year, in that we have both we're going to have a few more tickets available, and they'll be $40 this year for a taster, but we also have a $10 ticket for people that want to be the designated driver, and they can have, you know, water, and then we'll have snacks at the different places. And that's one of the reasons that the price has gone up a little bit, because we want to make sure that there are snacks at the different places. So we're looking for people who want to do that. And the exciting thing about it this year is, if you are a member of the museum, you can start buying the tickets before everybody else. And that would be May 3rd, you'd be able to buy tickets. And then we have our annual celebration on May 6th. And if you come, that's the pre-sale. So if you come on to our annual celebration on the 6th, you can get tickets then too. And then they go on that for the general public, people that aren't members or don't come to that, will be Tuesday, May 9th, and I'll just let you know that they sold out like 2 days after they went on. It was almost impossible to get tickets. So you have to, you know, the best thing for you to do is be a member, folks. Not only that, we are also very excited about the fact that we need some more board members. As we do more things, and we have five board members, four of whom are here right now, and that would include Betty Pierce, of course, and Dossie Boyd in the back, Kim Carver. Kim, wherever you are. Kim is in the back as well. And then me, our other board member is Bill Pendleton, and he wasn't able to come tonight, but we have space for four more. And as we try to do more things in our museum, we really need some help from the community. Not only that, we need to spread the word that we have a great museum that we're trying to make greater. And we can do these wonderful kinds of events and bring history to life if we have some help.
All right. You ready? Everyone's fed. Everyone's comfortable. Let's hear some more stories. Hillary Safran. Hillary was voted most theatrical in high school. This, if you know her, that makes sense. This has proven invaluable as a mother of three who has survived her children's teenage years. She brings her professional experiences in education, social services, workforce development, and performing to her workshops and keynotes. She began clowning as Hillary the Clown over 28 years ago and has entertained at many corporate events in Seattle, Alaska, and Colorado. Let's welcome Hillary Safran.
A man is not a plan. Born in Brooklyn more than 35 years ago, okay, maybe 40 plus, I had dreams like many other women of my generation. You graduate high school, you go to college, you get a job, you get married, you become a parent, a grandparent, then you retire and go to the promised land, Florida. Then you die. Well, life wasn't turning out like I thought it would. My mother died when I was 7, leaving my father and my brother and I. My father remarried soon after, and I inherited a stepmother and stepbrother, but we were not the Brady Bunch. It was more like the Long Island version of Mommy Dearest. So, unfortunately, my family took the word fun out of dysfunctional. I moved out before I graduated high school, got that, rented a room, and worked to support myself. I put myself through college, then moved to Manhattan after graduation for a series of jobs. I had been a theater and journalism major in college, and now I was in the Big Apple with big dreams and very little confidence in myself. So I worked a series of office jobs and took some vocal lessons because I love to sing. I even had some headshots taken for commercials, but found myself adrift and very emotionally unhealed, going nowhere fast. Things had not gotten better with my family. I had lost touch for several years. It was a very painful relationship. I even found out from a neighbor that my parents had moved to Florida 3 years before. I felt very lonely in New York. You could walk down the street among 200,000 people and feel very lonely. So at one of my jobs in New York, I met a gal who wanted to go to Seattle, and I thought, why not? I have nothing here. So we drove to Seattle. I needed a job, and I got a job in a commercial refrigeration shop for a man who was from Brooklyn. Who knew? Well, I was the dispatcher, and he didn't tell me his real age and that he was not really divorced and that he had 6 kids and his real age and when he took such a shine to me. Well, I didn't know what the term 26-year-old rebound and trophy wife meant when he asked me to marry him, but I knew, and I also knew he was like a father figure, but after I moved in with him, I was too emotionally entwined to get out. Before I know it, we had moved to California for 2 years, we got married, then came back to Seattle. I was a stepmother to 2 of his daughters, and his oldest child was 2 years younger than me. So it was like a bad Daniel Steele novel. Well, we had a beautiful son, and the marriage ended when I finally took myself to counseling because some very unhealthy things had occurred. Now I was a single mom of a 22-month-old child, fully responsible for our financial well-being because child support was iffy. So to be with my son, I became a preschool teacher, but it was never enough money. So one day I saw an ad in the Seattle Times, "Be a clown, we'll train." Well, that ad changed my life. Oh, yes. I ended up clowning for more than 26, 28 years. For extra income. It's fabulous. You get to earn 100 plus an hour and keep your clothes on. Well, I needed clown business cards, so I walked into a print shop one day when a nice-looking guy at the counter was starting to flirt with me. I think it was one of the first times in my life. I know it was the voice of God in my head. Leave him alone. He's a nut. Well, true to form, I ignored that red flag, and we were soon engaged. Well, he had an obsession to go to Alaska, which I did not. But in the endless quest of the search for Mr. Wrong, I soon followed him to Anchorage, Alaska, where he left my son and I high and dry. Well, my things were in storage, except for my clown suitcase and some valuables, and I needed a guitar to do some clown birthday parties, so walked into a pawn shop where the guy who sold me the guitar seemed enamored with me and started giving me jewelry, of course, from the pawn shop. Well, one of these jewels was an engagement ring. You think I would have gotten that red flag when he said 159 days. I didn't know what that meant. Sobriety. So he did tell me something early on. If you live in Alaska for more than 5 years and leave to go outside, and I always knew that wasn't the front porch, outside meant another state, you will come back. I'm like, what do you mean? Well, here I was now, married the second time. Now my son was 6, but I had never lived with an alcoholic and drug addict before. So, 2 babies and 4 years later, wanting to die, I finally divorced. Here I was with a college degree, work experience, 2 failed marriages, 3 children, and now on welfare. Where was the course Standards 101 in college? Well, 7 months after the divorce, I met a man who was a friend of mine. He was an airplane mechanic, loads of fun. I loved him, my kids loved him, but it was an on-again, off-again relationship due to our divorce scars. Well, I couldn't stand it anymore after several years of relationships, ups and downs, and I had become friends with his sister in Colorado. I had also met another guy named Mr. Really Wrong, who had an obsession to leave Alaska and also go to Colorado. So I thought I needed a change after 12 years in Anchorage, and so I moved to Colorado, worked in the employment field, and also learned ventriloquism to add to my clowning. Hello! So, among many other bad dating experiences later, an Alaska airplane guy not really letting go, and neither had I. Well, he wasn't really out of the picture, so after being laid off after 7 years in Colorado and finding my youngest daughter, then 15, dating a boy way too old for her, I thought it was time to come back to Alaska. So, 7 years ago, I decided to come back to the Matsu Valley, where I discovered that airplane guy was seriously dating someone else, which he forgot to tell me in the phone calls and visits to Colorado. But you know what? That was okay, because I learned that a man is not a plan. And so I also soon discovered VPA, the Matsu String Orchestra, the Borealis Dancers, and many other opportunities for performing more than ever in New York. I had the best vocal training in my life with Big Mitch in Anchorage, and I even performed at the Alaska State Fair several times. Well, one day I saw an ad in Make-A-Scene for something called Alaska Home Companion, which was sponsored by the Valley Arts Alliance, which is made up of women of similar age. And we all became great friends. Well, when my youngest daughter graduated high school and wanted to go back to Denver, I thought of going with her. Well, my new friend said, "No, stay here." Oh, by the way, ironically, most of my friends are happily married women. Yes, so I asked them to pull my arm, and so they did. Well, I bought a beautiful home in Palmer, and one of the ironies of my life is that my job in social services is finding employment for mostly women who thought a man was a plan and the dream went wrong, and so then they find themselves on welfare. I find them a job to get off welfare. And so if life does not turn out like you think it would at 13, 15, 18, 22, 25, okay, 32, 34, or 45, okay, maybe 52 or 59, maybe even 60, that's okay. Because that happened for me when I took a long, winding 35-year road to Alaska, where friends became my family, and I finally came home.
That's fantastic. You're so awesome. I love you. Oh, my gosh. That was perfect.
Oh, isn't she great? Wow. Thanks for sharing, Hillary. Oh, my. So now I guess I should reference that page on the front because we have Joe Furnell, right? Furnell. Joe Furnell, who is a retired shop teacher. He now works as a volunteer at the Museum of Alaska Transportation and Industry. And he's going to tell us a story about a long way from home. Let's give him a round of applause.
Have fun. Oh, yeah. This thing on? All right, it's on. I was born in Minnesota, but my first memory is Alaska. Is an Alaska memory, actually. It goes back to September 4th, 1951. I was about 2.5 years old at the time. I was out playing in the backyard behind our house in Rogers Park. Some of you know where that is. It was outside of Anchorage at the time. So our house was apparently on the landing pattern for Merrill Field, which was just across the flats. And I was kind of, even at that tender young age of 2.5, I was sort of used to airplanes flying over. Well, this one afternoon, it's a bright, sunshiny afternoon. This one airplane doesn't sound right. I look up, and there's fire coming out of it. I go running in the house, screaming for my mother, and tell her there's a plane on fire. Well, she takes my brother and me across the road to the neighbor, and She goes down to see if she can help, having been an Army nurse in the war, which was only 6 years ago, before that. And sadly, there were no survivors of that plane. The pilot did survive the crash. He died on the way to the hospital. That's sort of a sad story. He is buried in the Anchorage Cemetery. But anyway, moving on. In summer of 1958, anybody remember what happened? Okay. How about statehood? Statehood, oh yeah. Great news for Alaska, right? I mean, very exciting time, statehood, all this. Well, not so much for my family. My dad worked for the federal government. Guess what? What? He's out of a job. State's taking over what he was doing with the Public Health Service. So we had to move. Oh, boy. So where are we moving to? South America? Oh, my. Come on. Okay, so we go through the first half of the school year, fourth grade, and we pack the car up, and New Year's Day, 1959, we're on the road. So first night on the road, no problem. Second day, we cross into Canada. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon, what's it like up in Canada, Yukon Territory, 4 o'clock in the afternoon? Pitch dark? Yeah, it was pitch dark. So I was nodding off, dozing a little bit, and all of a sudden, hear my dad say, oh no, in a tone of voice I'd never heard before. Turns out he had overcorrected going around 90-degree bend there at Soldier's Summit, and the car did turn turtle, rolled over off the road, ended up on its roof there on the bank of Kluane Lake. Well, this was, remember, January 2nd. And it was 40 below, but, you know, that's just how it was. So my mother was resourceful, to say the least. So there we are in a car upside down in the dark. And she grabs the first thing that comes to hand to get us out of the car. Happened to be a bottle of wine that neighbors had given us. So she starts wailing away at the window. And the glass broke, all of it. The wine bottle and the window broke at the same time. Mountie asked my dad later if he had been drinking. So we get out of the car, we're out in the 40 degrees, and my brother and I end up under a couple of blankets. My dad got a fire going. Car comes by, stops, of course. Moving truck came by, it stopped. One of the passengers of the car is urging my dad to be sure you get all your stuff secured, get it taken somewhere, because there's vultures on the road and they'll pick your car clean. Years later, I'm wondering, is this guy? He went by the name of Blackie. Was this guy a vulture, maybe? It might have been a vulture, but it was his bad luck to come across the car with the people still there. Well, okay, the car, all the stuff got taken back to Destruction Bay, and we went on ahead, spent one night at Haines Junction. Ended up in Whitehorse for about a week while the car was put back to rights, and continued on up the road, down the road. And, lost my train of thought. It's derailed. So we continued on down the road, ended up outside of Washington, D.C., where my dad had to take Spanish lessons for several months before we were going to Cali, Colombia. Well, I was in for a rude awakening. Here I was, how old was I at the time? 9 years old, going on 10 years old. And all I knew was Alaska. Been born in Minnesota, but all I knew was Alaska. I mean, it was my world. So imagine my shock when one day at lunchtime I go outside for recess and I'm told I can't go out. Why not, I say. It's raining. Yeah, so? Well, I guess Alaska's the only place. Do kids still go outside for recess in the rain? Did when I was a kid. Then we decide we're going to go for a picnic. Going to go over to Rock Creek Park in Washington, D.C. Real nice place, my dad says. So, okay, we pack up some picnic stuff and we go over to Rock Creek Park. Rock Creek Park, wait a minute. My brother and I, we did have tasks when we had picnics. We'd go out to Seward Highway, we'd go over to Finger Lake when we were living here, and our task, gather rocks, make the fire ring. So there we are, we're looking, we're at this one likely spot, and we're looking for rocks to make a fire ring with. Rock Creek Park had the most anemic rocks you ever saw, but we finally got some rocks put together and got some semblance of a fire ring going, and a fire was put together, and next thing you know, here's the park police officer telling us, you can't have fires in Rock Creek Park. What? What do you mean we can't have fires in Rock Creek Park? I mean, how are you going to roast your weenies if you don't have a fire? Jeez, what's wrong with these people? I mean, it's a whole nother world outside, isn't it? I mean, one like that in Alaska. Well, so if that wasn't bad enough, I end up in Collie, Colombia. We're there for 2 years. Collie, as everybody knows, when we lived there, was 400 years old. Anchorage, how old was that? How old was Anchorage in the 50s? Yeah, 40 years old. I'm going from a city 40 years old to a city 400 years old? Talk about cultural shock. My poor little old 10-year-old brain didn't know how to compute, didn't know what was going on. I was having a pretty rough time with that. And pretty much the whole 2 years that we were living there in Collie, I swore I was going to come back to Alaska. I mean, that's my classmates, my teachers, everybody, they got tired of hearing me say, I'm going back to Alaska. Well, we left Columbia and ended up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. And life happened. High school, military, college, marriage, teaching, kids, widowhood. 2 years after I'm widowed, what happens? I meet my soulmate, Troy. And we get married the following year, and we're married about 4 years, and she says, well, you said something about you lived in Alaska once. Why don't we ever go there? I mean, Alaska, with life happening, had kind of just gone out of my mind as me going back there. Been back for a couple of visits, but not much more than that. Well, a couple of months or so later, we're in the little Echo, traveling up the Alaska Highway. Great trip. The little old lady biddies at the motels who would look at us with dirty looks, looking at my wife as a homewrecker and me as a dirty old man. But other than that, it was a good trip. And we got to Palmer here, and I told her how much I liked Palmer, that it was about my favorite town, even though I'd lived in Anchorage. Well, so we returned to Maryland, which is where I was living at the time, and we decided then and there that we were going to move to Alaska after I retired. Christmas 2003, I get best Christmas present ever, English Bulldog. His name was Palmer. Great little guy. So, had him for many years. We actually were able to bring him up here, and he experienced Palmer before he passed. So, a few more years passed. I retired from teaching, moved to the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, stayed there for about 10 years, retired from the state mental hospital, teaching middle school, retiring from the mental hospital. That's a logical progression. So, I retired from the mental hospital. Here it is, 2014. And we're finally getting here. November, we packed the car up, got the dogs in the car, we're all in the car, and we leave Virginia. And so what's happening there on the eastern seaboard and the Midwest or whatever that is, through Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, We're just beating the snowstorm by one day. So we get through and the snow hits. Whew. Okay. We get through Wisconsin, Minnesota, North Dakota, Montana. Temperatures in the teens. Well, we're probably going to see it that cold in Alaska, so okay. So, okay, you know, that's the four of us. Myself, Joy, the Palmer, and Kenai. Our two dogs and us. The four of us packed in this car and traveling up the road. We get into Canada. They're having a tropical heat wave. Temperature's about 30 degrees as we're traveling through Canada till we get to Dawson Creek. And, of course, we had the fog to deal with. But other than that, not too bad. Get to Dawson Creek and temperature turns normal again. So we're traveling up the highway and things are very uneventful. Thankfully, uneventful. So we're traveling on up the road and spend a night at Muncho Lake, Whitehorse. Y'all know the road. I don't need to tell you how it is. We decide to spend last night on the road at Tok. Here it is the couple of days before Thanksgiving, and didn't think it was going to be too bad. Well, overnight at Tok, temperature dropped to 12 below. Well, I didn't do anything in the way of preparation. Car battery was frozen. Had to take the battery out of the car, bring it inside. Kind of ran some warm water over it in the bathtub, got it thawed out, got it back in the car, got a jump start, got ourselves going, and we're traveling up the road to Palmer. Another 5 hours, we're pulling in our driveway. It took me 55 years, but I'm home.
Thank you for that story, Joe. It's almost interesting how our stories are all so different, but they're really the same. They have so much connecting us to Alaska. So thank you. Our next wonderful story is from Carmen Summerfield. Carmen grew up in the Netherlands, immigrated to the U.S. in 1987 from a career as an airline pilot, as a Boeing 747 pilot for Northwest Airlines, now Delta. She transferred to the AK base in 2000, and the family moved to Palmer. Carmen makes the time for the arts and designs and works on murals, paintings, and sculpture. Some examples include background scene panels for the VPA Center. I didn't know that. That's so cool. Murals for the Alaska State Fair, and cast iron pieces created at Art on Fire. Carmen is a founded member of the Valley Arts Alliance and volunteers in many community activities. Let's give a round of applause.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you. My story is called Twitchy, and that's the car I drove up to Alaska, but that was the third car that caught on fire, so that's my story. So we rewind a little bit, go back about 30 years ago when I immigrated to the States, and the first thing I bought was a motorcycle, but then my parents came to visit, so I had to buy a car. So I bought a Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme 1973 and shuttled my parents around in that. And I was amazed how big this car was, because I'm used to cars in Europe, and this is a two-door, and that's like barn doors on this thing. Anyway, so my parents go back to the Netherlands, so now you know where my accent is from. And I'm driving the highway by myself, and I'm thinking, well, this car ahead of me is in kind of bad shape, as it smells like burning oil. And I thought, well, that car is kind of far away, so maybe it's my car. So I So I pull over and I open the hood, and sure enough, flames are coming out. So now I'm running back and forth to get my stuff out of the car, and I still have my motorcycle helmet in there, and I'm thinking, well, is that worth dying for? Should I try one more time? And then a guy stops in a pickup truck with a fire extinguisher. So that was nice. He put out the fire. So then I bought another car, and I bought another Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme from 1977 this time. And that's all I could afford. I was a flight instructor at the time. So then my brother wanted to come and visit, and we wanted to drive across the United States from New York to L.A., We're in our early 20s. We're invincible. We thought this was a great idea. So we did. So I picked him up in Kennedy. We drove to LA. And then this whole fire theme kind of follows me around. So so then we're in a budget hotel in LA and sound asleep. And all of a sudden the fire alarm goes off in our room. And my brother panics, and he runs around all over the room flipping switches, and I had turned the master switch off, so he's panicking, oh, the electricity is out, oh my God. And in the meantime, you know, I don't smell any fire, I don't see any fire, and it's raining cats and dogs, and we're at the top floor, and what happened was water got into the fire alarm, and that's what set it off. But then he kind of came up with the phrase of brother panic and sister cool, so I thought that was pretty cool. So then we, it's the end of the year, so then we thought it was a great idea to start the new year to go to Death Valley. So we're driving to Death Valley, and of course there's nothing out there. We're not there quite yet. And then we realized that, well, maybe January 1, everything is closed, so maybe that's not a good destination. So we actually turn around, I'm driving, and all of a sudden there's smoke billowing up from the back seat. And my brother's panicking, and the car's on fire. I'm like, yeah, so, you know, I'll just pull over, you know. And at the time, we were both vegetarians, so, you know, we're eating rabbit food and birdseed and washing it all down with V8 juice, you know. So we used a can of V8 to put out the fire. And then we used the can to fix the problem. Because the exhaust, it's an old car, had burned a hole through the pipe into the bottom of the floor of the car, into the carpet. So the carpet was on fire. But then, you know, we fixed it. So, yeah. So now we fast forward. And I bought a 78 Chevy Impala station wagon. Now, the other one had barn doors. This was like the Queen Mary, okay? So I didn't have it long enough to catch on fire because I bought a two-year-old at the time, so it was an 88 Toyota Corolla SR5 two-door stick shift. Great car, but to me it looked like a sports car because any car compared to a Chevy Impala station wagon is a sports car to me. And then my husband drove it, and he thought it was kind of twitchy. Well, that's the name stuck, so that was twitchy. And then any car compared to a Chevy Impala station wagon is twitchy. So fast forward a couple of years, and now I'm working for a major airline out of Detroit, and Twitchy is sitting in the parking lot, employee parking. Sun's beating down on poor Twitchy all day. We go back, you know, go out for a week-long trip, and there's a heat wave. And at the time, Twitchy was still relatively new, young, and it still had one of those touch-up paint sticks. And it was in the glove compartment, and I had so much stuff in the glove compartment, lots of papers. And sure enough, the little paint stick set a fire in the... in the glove compartment. But I had so much stuff in there that was actually good because I think it actually ran out of oxygen. But, you know. So it burned itself out. So now we fast forward a couple of years. The car was still great, you know. So we actually drove that car to Alaska because my husband and I went up to visit. Really liked Alaska. And that's when I put in for a transfer to fly the 747s out of Anchorage here. So we drove Twitchy all the way up to Alaska. And then now, you know, fast forward a couple of more years, and Twitchy's about 20 years old and needs new shocks. And it's like, well, why would you put new shocks on an old car? That's not worth it. But it was embarrassing going through the drive-thru, like, here, please take my money, you know. So, and it was its own little snowplow at some point, too. But... then I finally, you know, I had to decide I had to buy a new car at some point. I thought, okay, for once in my life, I'm going to buy a new car. Didn't know what to buy, but I finally had my heart set on a Toyota FJ. Then Twitchy kept going for another 5 years because I wasn't going to give up Twitchy until, you know, it was ready. And then, they quit making the FJ, so... So now I finally donated Twitchy 2 years ago to Radio Free Palmer for their, for their donation program. You know, I hope they did get some money out of it. And I drive a Jeep Wrangler two-door stick shift. Now, it hasn't caught on fire yet. So thank you.
Thank you. Good job.
I think we all love Twitchy now. Thank you for that great story. And we are going to wind up our evening tonight with Jillian. Jillian Moon. Did I say it right, Jillian?
Yes.
Okay, there you are. I am not going to read your bio. I'm just going to let you come up here and tell your story. This is Jillian. Give a bigger round of applause.
You are such a princess. Those are the words that were hurled at me when I was working one night in an ICU in upstate New York. And I was waxing poetic about the travels I had. I was talking about going to Broadway and being in a limo and just the finer things in life that I really enjoyed. And this person was, "You would die if you had to take care of yourself in the real world." And I'm like, "No, I wouldn't." And she's like, "Yeah, you would." So, context. I'm a traveling nurse. I came to America in the 90s, and I was a travel nurse. I went everywhere else, like you said earlier. So you know what I mean? We went all over the place. But London, Paris, Rome, those were my people. I come to America, and I'm in Miami and New York and Boston. These are my people. I traveled in my little Toyota car with wine glasses, coffee cups, and Star Trek VHSs. I am dating myself, I know, but I ate out breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I had never even seen a fish in real life. I'd see the fish when it was wrapped up in that plastic thingy in the you know, supermarket. I never attempted to make it myself. So, upstate New York, at night, she says, you know, she was a different she was at a different travel company. So she was going to, she had got a contract in Alaska, and she said to me, "You will die." And she was Mother Earth. I was this tall, and I was a little bit bigger then, but I was fabulous. I had hair down to here, nails. I had heels. I was absolutely fabulous. And she was this wee thing, you know. She made her own bread. I think she grew the wheat or the threshing thing to make the bread, you know. And she was like, "I'm going to Alaska." I'm like, "Good for you." And she said, "You need to come with." I said, "Sure, I'll come with. I've heard of Alaska. There's Anchorage, and then there's this place. I think it begins with an F. It's north. So I'll go to Anchorage or this other city." And she's like, "No, we are going to find this small town in an island." And I'm like, and then she said those fateful words, "I double dog dare you." Just so you know, my life has been defined by those words. A perfectly good airplane jumped out of it because somebody said, "I double dog dare you." And then there was this great bridge in New Zealand, and somebody says, "Bungee jump off of that. I double dog dare you." Yeah, anyway, so I did, and there were skid marks to prove it, but we won't go there. So she goes, she sets up, and here I am. We're going to this little town in southeast Alaska, going to this little hospital. We're all big people, but whatever. So we land in Ketchikan, Alaska, in the airport. And then guess what? You have to take a ferry to town from the airport. What is a ferry? I know what a cruise ship is. With lots of people running around giving me champagne, but what is this ferry you speak of? It's pitch black, and I'm trying to see where we're going, and anyway, so we go over to the other side, and she picks me up, and I'm like, really? A ferry, huh? And she's like, shush. So we go up, and we're at her place on a hill. So we chat, we talk, we drink, we smoke, we go to bed. The next day, she said to me the night before, she says, when you wake up in the morning, you need to follow my instructions and don't question it. In context, we are not morning people, she and I, absolutely not. We do not speak in the morning. We have coffee, we have cigarettes, and we listen to music. That was our thing. So she says, when you wake up, just do what I say and just follow my instructions. I'm like, okay. So I wake up, there's coffee, and it was good coffee because we're snobs. And we had the good coffee with the grinds that we liked in the way we liked it. And we always had music playing, and it was a theme for us. At this point in time, the theme was Out of Africa. That was the soundtrack that we were listening to. So I wake up, I come out, she looks at me, she's got the coffee on, we go, eh. And so she pours me a cup of coffee. She says, close your eyes. I'm like, okay. I didn't say anything, I just closed my eyes. So she opened the door, all the blinds were down. She opened the door, my eyes were closed. She put me outside and put me to sit on the step, gave me a cup of coffee, lit a cigarette, and said, count to 10 before you open your eyes. So I did. And I could hear a lot of, you know, I could hear planes, I could hear just stuff. But I'm counting and I'm breathing in this crystal clear air that I've never breathed before. I'm like, I don't smell anything. I don't, it's so clear, my lungs feel weird. But anyway, so, and I'm like, not for nothing. The air was clear, okay? So I count 9 and 10. And I open my eyes. I see this vista before me. I'm on this hill, and there are mountains in the distance. It is the most clear sky I've ever seen. There are float planes going by, there are boats going by on the ocean in front of me. It is one of these crystal clear days that you can only have in Alaska. You know who Bart Simpson is, right? The Simpsons? You know when you see that cartoon and the clouds in the sky? I was like, holy shit, I'm looking at Bart Simpson clouds right now. And I'm like, I have never seen this, and my ears are popping because it's so quiet. I'm a city girl, I'm used to noises and ambulances and people and the hum of electricity. I did not know that I could hear the hum of electricity until I came to Alaska because I missed it. It was absent and my ears were popping. And I was sat there and I was like, my soul just took a breath and relaxed. For the first time in wherever I had been in the world, and I have been in many, many different countries, I've been in many different places and I've worked in so many different states. And for the first time, my soul found a home. Ketchikan, Alaska, the people that I've met, the things that I've experienced, I will never experience in any other place. And this is my soul's home.
Awesome girl.